back to the check-in for community connection and conversation over the airwaves. It's very nice to be back with you. History is written, but it's not written in stone. The way we view our history and its stories evolves as our culture and values evolve. Our legacies are shaped by our historians, our teachers, and our students with each new generation. Recently, following weeks of global pandemic that highlighted racial disparities in America, and following the killing of George Floyd and rising movements calling for racial justice, University of Missouri students went to administration with a request to remove from France's quad the statue of Founding Father Thomas Jefferson, an author of the Declaration of Independence and a slaveholder. The request has been denied with the statement, "We don't remove history." Today, we want to explore that Missouri history with three historians. That's coming up on The Check-In. Thank you for joining us on The Check-In here on KBIA today. We're talking today about Missouri history, race, our stories, and the symbols and monuments of those histories. And we're talking with three historians who are also, to some degree, Missourians and are very familiar with our histories and stories of race in Missouri and teaching those stories on a campus, particularly a Missouri campus. We have with us MU Professor Keona Irvin. Professor Irvin's most recent book is Gateway to Equality, Black Women and the Struggle for Economic Justice in St. Louis. Professor Irvin also curates many workshops, trainings, and series with the State Historical Society of Missouri, the Missouri History Museum in St. Louis, and the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Welcome to The Check-In, Professor Keona Irvin. It's great to have you here.
Thanks so much, Janet. It's a pleasure to be on.
And also with us is Walter Johnson. Professor Johnson is joining us from Harvard, where he's a professor of African and African American studies. But even more importantly, he's from Columbia, Missouri, and has written and researched extensively about racial disparities in St. Louis and Ferguson. He also co-founded the Commonwealth Project, which connects artists, activists, and academics for social change in St. Louis. Welcome, Professor Walter Johnson.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And we'll also be joined later on during this hour, in just a few minutes, actually, with Washington University professor and writer Shwande Mustakeem. You can also join us today. What do you want us to keep in mind right now on our campus, in our classrooms, and in our culture when it comes to our histories, our stories, and race in Missouri and on campus? And also, what are your thoughts on our symbols and statues depicting those histories? If you have comments or questions for our historians, or just something that you want to share about your experience right now, give us a call and you can join our discussion. Professor Johnson and Professor Irvin, it's so great to have you both here. You both center Missouri in your research, specifically St. Louis and Ferguson for you, Professor Johnson, in your research. First of all, let me just start with a really general question on what can the nation learn right now in this moment that we're in from Missouri's history that you would like us to keep in mind? Professor Irvin, let's start with you.
Oh, well, there's so much. I think from kind of the angle of my research, it's the long history of activism that has really shaped this state's history. I mean, I look particularly at St. Louis, but one of the aspects of activism in St. Louis was just how connected many local residents were to residents of other parts of the state. And so this kind of rich legacy, I think, of activism has been not just important for shaping a kind of Missouri narrative around race, racial justice, and responses to racial violence, but it has also really reverberated nationally. So many organizers in the 20th century, for instance, were very much on a kind of, had a kind of national reach in terms of the work they were doing in the city, in my case, in St. Louis.
All right. And Professor Walter Johnson, you've written about Ferguson specifically, and I want to hear about that. But let me just ask you the same general question. You know, you're out there at Harvard. What comes to mind when you're watching these events and these movements for racial justice and demonstrations unfold? As a Missourian, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, unsurprisingly, I think I agree with Professor Irvin, from whom I've learned so much, that the history of St. Louis and the history of Missouri generally has provided a very deep and powerful lineage of black radical organizing, and particular organizing by black women, but also by militant black men and by communists and other sorts of radicals. What I think of when I look at the history of St. Louis is I think the history of St. Louis has both shaped and prefigured the history of the United States. And so I think that if you look at what's happening in the United States now, what's happened over the last month, it really, to me, was prefigured in September of 2017 in St. Louis with the set of protests and the police riot in the aftermath of the acquittal of the police officer Jason Stockley, who killed a man named Anthony Lamar Smith. And so what I try to do then is to use the history of St. Louis almost as a way to understand what will happen next in the United States. And I think that what I see in St. Louis today is both a resurgence of African-American politics, a new generation of African-American politicians coming up, whether you're talking about Kim Gardner or Wesley Bell, or whether you're talking about Cori Bush, but also a lot of people organizing themselves and doing radical, visionary social and political work outside of the boundaries of conventional politics.
Let me just remind listeners, you're listening to The Check-In on KBIA. We're talking about Missouri history, race. On today's show, we're also going to be talking about our symbols of our history. And we're talking with two historians who are experts in the black experience in Missouri and beyond. We're joined by MU's Keona Irvin and Harvard's Walter Johnson. Do you have a question or comment for our guests about race and Missouri's history, how our statues and monuments symbolize and depict our history and our stories? You're welcome to join our discussion with a question or a comment. Professor Johnson, you have mentioned in an article that you wrote for the Atlantic Monthly after Ferguson that it's easy to see, you know, a big event like a police killing that captures everyone's attention. I think many people are looking for what's underneath that. And you said that when you look underneath what happened in Ferguson with the killing of Michael Brown, that what you found was a lot, an undercurrent where black residents in Ferguson and many places are paying fines and fees that municipalities rely on for public services. Can you elaborate on this economic disparity that's happening because of our municipalities and their financing?
Yeah, I think it's a difficult thing to assimilate in the face of the horror of the police killings. Mm-hmm. But the police killings are, I think, a symptom. They're a symptom of what's wrong in the society, and they're a symptom of the degree of social abandonment of African American and poor communities, and they're a symptom of economic inequality. And so what I was trying to identify there is the way in which, over the course of the 20th century in St. Louis, African Americans have been shut out of the labor market when there was a vigorous labor market in St. Louis, and then driven into certain neighborhoods and contained in those neighborhoods as the economy of St. Louis declined and more of the jobs either moved to St. Louis County or moved out of the state and even the country entirely. And so what I see now in places like North St. Louis or in North County is a population, largely African-American population, that is not useful to industry. It's been rendered, these people have been rendered inert from the standpoint of production, because there are no jobs that they can get to, you know, crummy public transportation, et cetera, extend the list. But they're being sort of rendered up for a last round of extraction. And that it could be payday loans, or it's for-profit policing, where the municipalities which are giving out all sorts of corporate welfare in the form of tax subsidies to, you know, to Walmart or to Express Scripts or to Home Depot or to Emerson Electric, are then trying to close their budgetary gaps with fines and fees, with extreme and regressive taxes on the mostly African-American population.
All right. And Kiana Irvin, you also write about the struggle for economic justice by black women in Missouri. Do you see history repeating itself here? And we have to be somewhat quick because we have to take a break, but we'll continue the discussion. But let me just put that in there. Do you see history repeating itself when it comes to economic justice for you?
I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't say necessarily repeating itself, but certainly there is a kind of strong thread of continuity that kind of connects what we're seeing today, the issues that organizers out of St. Louis are raising, and the kind of the work, the political work that the women I studied were doing in the 20th century. So the quest for a kind of economic dignity, of challenging the understanding that ordinary black people are disposable, right? It's very much a thread that we see through then and now.
Yeah. All right. We're going to continue this discussion on the check-in when we come back from the break. We'll also continue talking with Professors Kiana Irvin and Walter Johnson. We'll also bring in Professor Shwande Mustakim, who's going to join us right after this break on the check-in. Welcome back to The Check-In. Today we're talking about Missouri and history and racial justice and what we can learn from places like Ferguson and how we reevaluate our history and our heroes and legacies through the generations on this march through time. You can join our conversation. What do you want us to keep in mind when it comes to our histories, our stories, and race in Missouri and on campus? And what are your thoughts on our symbols and statues depicting those histories? How can we do better at inclusivity on our campuses? And how do our symbols and monuments impact this? And we're back with our guests. We've got three historians we're talking with today. Professor Kiana Irvin from MU, Professor Walter Johnson from Harvard, who is also from Columbia, Missouri. And we're going to bring in now Professor Shwande Mustakim. Professor Mustakim researches and centers the stories of enslaved African-American women in our history, among many other things. And she teaches a course called Slavery and Memory in American Popular Culture. So we thought that Professor Mustakim would be an amazing person to check in with today. Welcome, Professor Mustakim.
Oh, thank you. It's such an honor to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. So in your work, Professor Mustakim, you really seek out the unknown, the hidden. You were one of maybe the first scholar to center the experience of an anonymous enslaved woman in an academic essay, which I think no American journal would publish, and it was finally published in a British journal. It's entitled She Must Go Overboard and Shall Go Overboard, and it's part of your research about the Middle Passage and transporting in the slave trade. Can you talk about where that title came from and also why no one wanted to publish that story?
Sure, and thank you for beginning there, because that has been the doorway to the beginnings of trying to uncover the overlooked, the unknown, and the intentionally forgotten, if we would say, but essentially those unremembered. And unfortunately, females and black females are a category of those that have been forgotten for a long time. And this woman, I would find, who would be, she really tells a medical narrative that speaks to quarantine, that speaks to race, that speaks to gender, and also how we remember diseased bodies. So she had smallpox, but the title comes from a quote from the ship captain who demanded that she be thrown overboard because he was fearful that she would contaminate this entire ship. And so essentially she would be tied down to a chair, blindfolded, and then left for dead in the middle of the ocean. And then he would go on and be able to make profit, essentially benefiting from an industry and a human manufacturing system that would go on for centuries. And so in telling the stories of the unknown and the unforgotten, it is beginning to having to reimagine a world where this was normal and legalized.
Okay, that's fascinating. And, you know, you were making me realize, you know, as you talk about the unknown stories and unnamed women that you write about from slavery and so much and the memory of these stories, and there's so much to unpack there with you and all three of you, really, that we have on today. Let me turn to, you know, the life of an enslaved woman that we do know the name of, which is Sally Hemings. And we have this controversy, you might call it, or a moment kind of unfolding on our campus where the students have petitioned for the removal of Thomas Jefferson's statue on our main quad. And we had recent graffiti that said, "Say her name, Sally Hemings," five words, "Say her name, Sally Hemings." What would you like, Shwande Mustakim, for people on our campus, our staff, faculty, our leaders and students to keep in mind when it comes to the story of Sally Hemings?
Well, I think as Dr. Johnson and both Dr. Irvin were mentioning, we have this Missouri narrative, and then there is also the longer history in how we tell those stories. So it's the longer evolution. So it is not just one, it is remembering that those who came before. So essentially being mindful of how are we at this point of discomfort and unease that is essentially about race. And how did we get there? It is sort of building these narratives and the everyday experiences that allow for the degradation of many, but especially Black people, that at the same time is privileging a whole other narrative and everyday experiences of race that, again, allow for these privileges. So in understanding why one, why the other, it is about understanding that we have a wider landscape and a more textured human narrative that includes many more than just one archetype. So it is about understanding and intentionally including even more and being gendered intentional all the way through.
All right. Let me just remind our listeners that you're listening to The Check-In, and we're talking with historians Shwande Mustakim, Kiona Irvin, and Walter Johnson, and we're talking about Missouri history, race, and how our stories are remembered. Professor Irvin, is this a natural part of history? All of three of you could weigh in on this. Is it natural to do, as I was saying in the intro, to sort of evolve our histories with new generations? Is this something that historians are used to doing, reevaluating our heroes?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we are, you know, the notion of we're shaped by history, that history lives, that it is a living entity, absolutely shapes the kinds of ways that historians tackle, you know, certain historical subjects. And so, for instance, the civil rights movement, Black power struggle of the 1960s, very much reshaped the ways that historians were writing about the past, particularly African-American history, Black history. And so, absolutely, just to kind of echo a bit of what Dr. Mustakim was saying there, it's just this notion that the powerful kind of uprisings that we're seeing across the country are challenging, right, these narratives that we have about the past, right, that the link between the pain and the anger, the rage over the murder, for instance, of George Floyd or Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, right, is very much connected to, many are saying, and I would agree, connected to the ways that we think about and remember the past and what kinds of narratives are actually told about the past. So the call for a more complicated history, a more difficult history, is very much in line with what we've seen throughout history, in fact, especially in the 20th century.
So when you see students petitioning to reevaluate this history with Thomas Jefferson, does that seem like a healthy thing as historians and part of a natural process of history? It sounds like you're saying that's the case. Professor Walter Johnson, I mean, how should we view, how do you view the legacy of Thomas Jefferson?
I have a narrow answer and a broad answer. The narrow answer is that I think as a historian, what I would do is look at the history of the monument. Monuments are expressions of power, the power to put up a monument or the power to take down a monument. That particular monument was put up in 2001 by the Jefferson Club, which is a group of wealthy donors to the University of Missouri. I don't have anything against wealthy donors per se. My university depends entirely on wealthy donors, including Jeffrey Epstein, so I don't want to sound as if I'm disrespectful of those who give their money to Mizzou. I've given some of my money to Mizzou, all right? But what you see then is a monument, really, to the abandonment of the University of Missouri by the state of Missouri and the replacement of funds from the state of Missouri by privately donated funds. And so what I would want to do then is to begin with a conversation about the monument and then to try to trace back to a conversation about social abandonment. My view of monuments in general, I must admit, is quite astringent, in the sense that I've been asked in public about Civil War monuments. I think that at the very least, the Confederate monuments should be what art historians call transformed in place, what is vernacularly called vandalism. And we've seen that all across the country, people coming to reckoning with monuments in a democratic way. I'm actually not a big proponent of the Union Army monuments because so many of those are to people who were Indian killers. So I think we need to reevaluate all of them, and that would certainly go for a Jefferson monument. The ostensible reason for the Jefferson Memorial at the University of Missouri is his support of public education and the Louisiana Purchase. And Jefferson's support of public education, as my colleagues, Professor Muscatine and Irvin, know, was articulated in the Notes on State of Virginia in a chapter where he recommended the colonization, i.e. the extraterritorialization, the banishment, deportation of free people of color. And so I think that there's a complicated legacy there that is not served by the presence of the 2001 monument on the quadrangle.
All right. Let me go to you, Professor Irvin, and then you, Professor Muscatine. What would you say to our campus leaders what would you like to see our campus leaders saying to our students as we go forward on the question of the Thomas Jefferson statue? The statement that they got back was, we don't remove history. They did say we want to see it in context. It sounds like you all three of you, in a way, are saying that part of that context is an evolution of the way we see our history. Professor Irvin, any thoughts on that?
I mean, on the one hand, I'm specialized in, kind of Black history courses, Black history in the United States in particular. And, the work of that field is the kind of work of kind of complicating what we might understand as kind of prevailing or dominant narratives, right, of U.S. history. So I think at the very least, or at the very beginning, as I said kind of earlier, a more complicated rendering, a more expansive rendering of these histories is absolutely step one. And that's something, of course, that happens in the classroom. But if we're thinking about kind of a campus, we need to think about kind of community education and community, thinking on the level of community, how, in a sense, can a campus kind of reckon with these much more difficult histories that are emerging, whether, we like it or not, we might say.
Okay. Professor Muscatine, do you have thoughts on this event that's playing out on our campus, on this petition from students? Any thoughts?
I very much do. And I think being one who grew up in Stone Mountain, so understanding symbolism and the power, and then, just how it reverberates in culture to hear people singing the Dixie song while you're there for a laser show. I want to go to immediately what comes to mind with all of this is that it speaks to a national conversation about whether they stay up or whether they come down. And that is about really thinking about the education. Just as Dr. Irvin was speaking to, community education is important. So this becomes a moment of universities have an opportunity to partner with the community to empower. So what that means is that everyone cannot go to college and be able to take these courses to be able to be educated on these histories that inform the institutions, that inform the state. So in that way, maybe it is beginning to think, going back to decades ago, where we're seeing the partnership of Black studies as well as just other people who are committed to activism and keeping the conversation within and beyond the academic and ivory sort of the ivory towers. But the other thing, curriculum is so powerful because I've been speaking to this in my work for so many years, and that way trying to write and empower for teachers. So there is the conversation within the university, but this is where we can begin to bring in teachers and educators. It is about bringing in sociologists, but it is, again, bringing in the political sciences, but also the business world. This is about the investments, you know, and where and how that's allocated. We've got to think about that. What does it cost? It shouldn't just go. Essentially, what I'm trying to say is that African American studies has always been at the centerpiece of these conversations, and this is a moment where it should be shared, where all of us are really looking at what is it to be intentional in the collective movement forward and not just allowing the scales of power to allow the balance of power to fall on one side or the other.
It sounds like all three of you are saying this is an opportunity for conversation, as you're saying, Professor Mustakeen, not just for campus. It's very relevant that this is happening on a campus, and these are students, a new generation of students, engaging with their history by asking these questions. And so more engagement and more conversation and dialogue and learning would be part of the answer, yes?
Absolutely. And beginning to really think about, what do we allow? What do we allow the consumption of? So this is where teaching a course where students are excited and they want to know, how did we get to this? What is it that is informing us in our education and our television and our Netflix and our any of it in our documentaries? What are they telling, and how, again, are we thinking about the manufacturing of narratives? So this is a very vital opportunity.
All right. Thank you, Professor Shwande Mustakeen. You also, you know, you make real in your work the terror and trauma and violence of the slave trade, taking us away from that bucolic plantation view that is sometimes portrayed at places like Monticello, if you've ever toured it. That's not to completely disregard Monticello. It's probably, I think they're changing and evolving in the way they do their tours as well. But it does, those stories, I think, and your stories that you're unearthing are really important for understanding the life of someone like Thomas Jefferson. And as you say, Professor Irvin, the complicated rendering of these people. So it sounds like context and dialogue is key. Professor Mustakeen, you also say with your students that you tell them you can't unknow a story. What do you mean when you say you can't unknow a story?
Oh, and at that point, this is where we're beginning to think about memory. We want to believe that we'll remember. However, it gets into you where it'll come back up. You cannot say, oh, I've never heard that before. It will come back up, and so you can't unknow. At that point, it is a part of your world, and then it is about making meaning of it. And all of it, whether we're talking about paracentric slavery and understanding the histories, or again, just really grappling with pain and the fact of the human experience. So I am very known for invoking the word, you can't unknow now.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you for that reminder for us here on the check-in as well. Let me leave all three of you with we've just got about a minute, so let me just give all three of you a chance to just say, what would you like to see our campus and our culture here at the University of Missouri, as we're getting these questions? We also have a hashtag Black at Mizzou Twitter thread going on. Can you all leave us with just a few seconds of your thoughts on what you'd like to see campus leadership and community keeping in mind right now? Do you want to start us off, Professor Irvin?
Well, I think just briefly, to go back to a point made earlier, just the notion of community, right? To really think about that, to critically kind of interrogate that understanding, and to use the resources of the campus, as Dr. Mustakeen is articulating there, to educate, to provide and unpack, provide a kind of education around these histories, I think would be really a good step forward.
That sounds great. Anything to add to that, Professor Johnson and Professor Mustakeen?
I mean, I think I'd like to see people demand better support from the state of Missouri for African American studies, ethnic studies, and other sorts of dissident intellectual life. I'd like to see, and this is something that I'm working on at Harvard, the disarmament of campus police force. And I'd like to see a monument at Mizzou to Professor Arva Strickland, who was the founder of Black Studies at Mizzou and who held that up for a very long time and made space for African Americans at Mizzou.
All right. That's a great specific idea to leave us with. Unfortunately, now we are out of time. It went by way too quickly. So we're going to take a quick break on the check-in. Let me say thanks so much to the three Missouri historians we've been talking with, Professor Keona Irvin, Professor Walter Johnson, and Shawande Mustakeen, professor at Washington University down the road. Thanks for joining us on the check-in today. We're going to come back after this break. We'll talk with two of the original Concerned Student 1950 activists about where they are now, what they're doing, and what advice they have for students working for change. That's right after this break on the check-in. All right. Welcome back to the check-in. Thanks for being with us today. We're talking about Missouri history and race and how we tell and teach these histories in an inclusive campus environment today. We're joined now by two of the original founders of MU's Concerned Student 1950 movement, which led the student protest movement 5 years ago. You can also join us on the check-in today. What questions or comments do you have for our guests about student activism, campus equity and inclusion, and the way forward? How can we do better at inclusivity on our campuses, and how do our symbols and monuments perhaps impact this? We have today joining us Peyton Head. Peyton is joining us from Chicago. Since graduating from MU in 2016, Peyton has worked nationally with the U.S. Department of Education and the National Educational Leadership Council on improving equity on campuses and beyond. He's also worked internationally as a speaker with the United Nations and the African Union on youth initiatives and the African diaspora. We're hoping that Peyton Head can join us here in a few moments. First, though, we have Ayanna Poole joining us. Ayanna is a 2015 graduate of MU with her degree in African American Literature and Creative Writing, and she's a founder of the original Concerned Student 1950 movement. Ayanna is also currently a seventh grade teacher in Texas and has worked as an educator for 5 years. Welcome, Ayanna Poole.
Hello, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you on. So, and hopefully we'll be joined here in a few minutes by Peyton Head. We've been corresponding by email a lot this morning, so I feel like he's close. Mm-hmm. So we'll just see if we get him on the line. But in the meantime, Ayanna, I'm so glad you're here. And you've done a lot since your time at MU, and you're now working on the front lines as a school teacher. And you've probably kept a little bit in touch with the Black at Mizzou hashtag, also the petition to remove the Thomas Jefferson statue. There's, you know, in this larger national movement of racial justice and awareness that's going on, our students here, as you were 5 years ago, are engaging and activating. What would you say to the student activists working for change right now? Let me start with that general question. What would you say to them?
There's so much power that's on campus. And I think that oftentimes, let me not say I think, because the
go ahead, Ayanna. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, you're fine. So there's so much power that's on campus, that's been on campus for so long. And oftentimes we see that they create policies in order to really silence our Black and brown students on campus. So just really reminding those students that they have so much power, and just to continue the fight, because they are fighting a very, very just fight. If we look at the history of the University of Missouri, our ancestors built this university, and they continue to uphold these reminders of white supremacy and ignore the history of our campus and how Black bodies have always been a cornerstone of the university's foundation. It's just as much our campus as it is anyone else's, regardless if it's a PWI. And so, you know, just continue to fight against the perpetuation of violence on Black bodies, because it's a very valid fight. We have every right to be included in that history of the University of Missouri and that tradition, because we are very much a part of it. So just continue in that fight.
Okay. And Peyton Head is with us now. Peyton, we've already introduced you and your work a little bit, but would put the same question to you. First, I'll say welcome to the check-in. And also, just Thanks for being here. And just to ask the same question that we just asked Ayanna Poole, what would you say to the students that are activating on campus right now, petitioning for the removal of the Thomas Jefferson statue, also telling their stories on the hashtag Black at Mizzou Twitter thread? There's engagement going on here. What would you say to students working at MU campus right now?
I would continue to tell the students to continue to use their voices, speak up and speak out, love and support one another while they do this in the process. I'm very, very proud of them as they continue this advocacy work, and understanding that it's, you know, it's a movement, not just one singular moment that leads to, you know, whatever it is, making a just and equitable campus for everybody. So I'm just really proud of the students as they continue to organize and motivate. And also I listen to the words of Dr. Treva Lindsay, who always says, breathe, fight, and repeat.
All right.
So that's the advice that I would give to the students.
Okay, that's great. You're listening to The Check-In, and we're checking in right now with Ayanna Poole and Peyton Head, two original activists with the Concerned Student 1950 movement on MU campus 5 years ago. They both work now on the front lines of equity and education. Ms. Poole works on the front lines as a school teacher in Texas, and Mr. Peyton Head is working on national and international initiatives with the African Union, the UN, and the U.S. Department of Education on youth initiatives. They both know some stuff about campus activism. So if you're working to make change on your campus or in your classroom as a student or a teacher or other, give us a call. We've got just a few more minutes of our show here, and it's been a packed one, but we'd love to hear your comments or questions for Mr. Peyton Head or Ms. Ayanna Poole. Peyton, we want to get into some of your international work and leave time for that, but let me first get your perspective on bringing about change on campuses. You've talked with and worked with a lot of MU chancellors and committees working on change. How far would you, I want to hear this answer from both of you. Let me start with you, Peyton. How far would you say MU has gotten since Concerned Student 1950?
That's a great question. It's very difficult to kind of measure success because there's still hurt and pain. And also too, you know, correcting history in the way in which we teach it that has not still been addressed on campus. So I wouldn't even look at not necessarily how far it has been come, but I would also say there's just so much further to go. And I think that sometimes when we get complacent, you know, and say like, oh, we've done this, this and that, we get comfortable. So I would encourage students, faculty, and staff, and administrators to constantly ask themselves, where are we now, and how can we continue to move forward?
Okay, Ayanna Poole, do you want to answer that question too?
Yes, I would like to agree with him. For Concerned Student 1950, we had 6 of our demands met. The reality of that, though, is that it was 5 years ago, and there's so much that's transpired on campus. And so the reality is that there is still work that needs to be done, and it's very reflective in the work that the students are doing now. And so I will say that I appreciate the work that has been done so far, but there are plenty of things that I've been communicating with students that are currently on campus and things that I've seen through the Black at Mizzou hashtag that reminds me that there's always still work to be done.
Okay. Many faculty that work on these issues and students and colleagues say they are tired, understandably, and a recent ACE report on MU's progress used the word exhaustion. I don't know if either of you have seen that, but is the American Council on Education report on MU and its progress. How do organizers, faculty, students get past the exhaustion to make change? Ayanna Poole?
The reality is the work is exhausting. And I am still doing some of this work through BLC, and I am still exhausted, right? Mm-hmm. And so getting past it really means for those students and those faculty members that are working to make sure they're taking time for themselves whenever they need to, because this is a very taxing job that I don't believe that we should have to do. I would also say, especially to those students, is also to just remember that all of this work does not need to be done by them. There are things that the board of curators need to do. There are things that administration needs to do. And so really telling them what needs to be done, but not doing the work for them, because that can take away some of that exhaustion that comes from putting forth those efforts and those initiatives.
All right, Peyton.
I would echo everything Ayanna says, but I would also say support is critical and crucial to any movement and any type of progress that's being done on campus. And it can't be one person's problem. And I think that's sometimes the issue. Like, you look at the industry, not only at MU, but like across the nation and the world around diversity and inclusion efforts. And you find that there's a high turnover rate for people who lead these initiatives because people are exhausted. Faculty are exhausted. This is exhausting, especially when you're coming against, you know, these systems that continue to silence and invalidate the things that people are saying over and over and over again. I work with university presidents a lot, and they always want to know, well, what can I do to be more inclusive? And I always ask them, like, did you speak to any students on campus? And they say, oh, I never really thought about that. I'm like, have you been listening to what they're putting out on social media? Have you been following the hashtags going out about your campus? Have you been actively, like, taking a look at the climate and seeing what you can do within your power to make real change, as opposed to always asking everyone around you, you know, what needs to be done? Because the answers, a lot of times, especially on the local level, are very, 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 very close to us.
That's great. Ayanna, you work as a teacher now. What are you seeing when it comes to equity in education at that beginning level?
One of the things that I've seen implemented here recently or in the past few years is being more intentional about restorative justice practices on campuses. It's something that I definitely appreciate. We also saw in my district specifically last year an initiative to do social emotional learning. I teach in secondary, but these are kids who are just getting out of that elementary education, and they're ready for these conversations. We need more culturally competent campuses, teachers, students. I mean, the entire campuses need to take up this idea of being culturally competent in order to best serve our students. Sure, we see a lot of racial disparities, especially in the way that data is presented, especially when we look at those districts who have different demographics across their campuses. But being really, really intentional about making sure that we're taking care of those Black babies who already have so much against them in their communities, and making sure that we're creating the safe haven for them in schools where they're able to actually engage in this critical dialogue that's going to help them to grow and be these change agents that we are supposed to be when they grow up and when they excel past the secondary education level.
All right. Let me just remind our listeners, we've got a few minutes left of the check-in, and we're checking in right now with Ayanna Poole and Peyton Head, two original activists with the Concerned Student 1950 movement on MU campus, and they've done a lot since then, and they know some stuff about campus activism. So if you're working to make change or wanting to see change made on any of our campuses here in Missouri or in your classroom as a student, a teacher, you can join us with your comments or questions just here in the last few minutes. And Peyton, since your time at MU, you've really studied global and international development at the University of Chicago, and you've traveled internationally. You could probably write a book about this, but I'm just going to ask you, what would have you learned from your international work and travels? How has that changed your perspective on race in America?
Wow.
Like I said, you could write a book.
I know, I really could. I think the biggest thing that I've learned is how this work that's being done in America around race relations and inclusion, equity, diversity, whatever it may be, it's global. And I think my travels really taught me about the global perspective of the African diaspora and how many of the issues that we're working to, or liberation that we're working to here in the U.S., is a global phenomenon. Like when I lived in Amsterdam for a little bit, I spent time at the Black Archives and studied the documents and history of race relations in the Netherlands. And, you know, we learn about the Dutch East India Company many times in K-12 education as one of the first multinational corporations in the world, but we don't talk about, like, the exports, spices, and people, you know? And so sometimes we think that this is so based in America because the issue right now is on America, but a lot of the issues that we're trying to reconcile with, you know, deal with anti-Blackness, deal with Afrophobia as global structures. And so these were the things that I was seeing while, you know, in Senegal and Amsterdam and conversations in Geneva, Switzerland, even being at the European Union Parliament in Strasbourg. There was one bar that I wasn't served in because of the color of my skin. And all of my friends who were with me, who were white, you know, they did whatever they could, you know, to try to, like, you know, protest and stand against this. But this is this anti-blackness is something that we have to deal with all over the world. And so this is more than just an American conversation. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing solidarity and with people in countries all across the world with the movement that's happening currently here in the U.S. This isn't just a U.S. issue. It's never been a U.S. issue.
No, that's fascinating. It sounds like you should write a book. Ayanna Poole and Peyton Head, hang on one moment while we take a phone call. We've got a caller. Ellie Bonilla is calling in, and Ellie is organizing an event, Como for Love. Ellie, thanks so much for calling into the check-in. What do you have going on?
Hi. So basically, Tuesday, we have put together an event to raise money for the Black community, specifically after-school programs that work with at-risk youth, kids in the project, and also just programs here in Columbia that are helping, you know, uplift Black people and minorities. And yeah, we've gotten some artists together, and we're some good people that make great food, great chefs, and yeah, we're
okay.
Thanks together. Yeah.
That's great. Well, thanks for calling in to tell us about this, Ellie. And this is going on Tuesday. Is it at Cafe Berlin?
Yes, it's going to be outside in the parking lot.
Okay. And oh, it's going to be outside. And you're a comedian, Ellie. Are you going to be doing some comedy on Tuesday?
No, I'm not. This isn't about me. So I'm trying to stay out of the spotlight as much as possible. And, you know, give a platform to people, but unfortunately, no.
Okay, well, I wanted to ask you about that because it seems like a tough time to be a comic right now. We'll keep a lookout for your comedy down the road. Thanks for calling in with that. It's Como for Love happening Tuesday, Cafe Berlin. Thanks for the heads up on it, Ellie, and thanks for checking in.
All right.
No take
problem.
Care.
Thank you.
Bye bye, and. Ayanna Poole and Peyton Head, we only have a few more minutes. Let me just use our last 30 seconds or so to just ask you all for any final words that you would have. You, I think, both have been following the Black at Mizzou thread, where students are sharing their experiences specifically with MU campus. What would you say to them? What would you like to leave them with as we go out of our check-in? Ayanna, do you want to go first?
One of the most recent things, I'll just address the removal of the Thomas Jefferson statue, because that's one of the most immediate things that I've seen. Back in 2015, we actually saw Maxwell Little, who was a founding member of Concerned Student 1950, actually release the same thing.
Okay.
And so just really, really reminding those students that this is an ongoing fight. A no is not a no. Organize, be intentional, power map, and strategize.
All right. That's fantastic, Ayanna. Peyton, we just have about 10 seconds. Any final words for us?
I would just say wherever you are, use your platform and feel empowered to speak up and speak out. The urgency of now is imperative.
That's great. Peyton Head and Ayanna Poole, thank you so much for joining us on The Check-In. That's it for this week's check-in. Thanks also to Professors Shwande Mustakeen, Keona Irvin, and Walter Johnson. Thanks for you for checking in with us today on our new weekly hour-long version of the show. It's produced by Christopher Husted and me with Ryan Famuliner, Zia Kelly, and Hannah France. We'll be back next Thursday, same time and same place. You can also podcast The Check-In wherever you get your podcasts. See you next Thursday. Until then, I'm Janet Saidi. Stay well and stay in touch.